From awaytogarden.com and robinhoodradio.com, this is Away to Garden with Margaret Roach, your weekly invitation to dig in and grow.
Most of the so-called pests I get questions from gardeners about are the ones that feast on plants, cabbage worms and black vine weevils or Japanese beetles and the like. But today we're going to talk about a different kind of pest. Ticks, the foulest and nastiest creatures that be. So said Pliny the Elder, the ancient Roman scholar who wrote a massive natural history of the world in the first century AD. Ticks have been on the planet far longer, of course, some experts say for about 120 million years. For about the last 20, scientists at the nearly 2,000-acre Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, have collected hundreds of thousands of ticks, seeking to understand how environmental conditions influence the infectious disease risks that ticks are implicated in. Today's guest, prominent disease ecologist Dr. Richard Ostfeld, heads that research effort, and I'm so happy to welcome him to the program, just as what gardeners and others who love the outdoors often call tick season begins. Welcome, Rick. How are you?
Thanks very much. I'm fine, thanks.
Are you suited up in your white suit out hunting for ticks, or what's going on over there?
Well, I will be soon. At the moment, I'm safely inside my office
okay.
In regular street clothes.
You're hermetically sealed.
Yes, exactly.
Good, okay. I will say that as a neighbor to Cary for many years, I've been following your work and that of your colleagues, and I'm just always so in awe when new work is published and how much has been going on and just the intimate understanding of the natural world that really comes from your exploration. So that's just a compliment to start us off.
Thank you very much for that compliment.
So how long have you been researching ticks? And we should say it's not the only thing that you do, but how long has this work been going on?
Well, it's been going on almost ever since I arrived at the Institute in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
I started a project. I was trained as a mammal ecologist, and what we do, mammal ecologists, many of us go out and trap small mammals and other kinds of creatures. And here at the Institute, I noticed back in 91 or so that the mice in the Hudson Valley were just covered with ticks. And that was alarming and interesting to me, and so I've been pursuing it ever since.
So that's a long time, and currently the direction of the work, has it kind of, do new things reveal themselves? I mean, what's the current, the sort of current aha or the things you're exploring at the moment about it?
Yeah, all the time. I mean, I would get bored if the same thing were going on for 23 years and nothing new were happening. But there are new things all the time. We've made some discoveries that have to do with how acorn production by our oak trees and that are so common in our forests are driving the mouse and chipmunk populations through ups and downs, and how that in turn drives tick and pathogen populations through ups and downs. More recently, we've been getting very interested in how predators control our risk of exposure to Lyme disease and other tick-borne diseases. And
okay.
And that reminds me of yet another interest, is that we always seem to be discovering new tick-borne diseases. Every few years, there's a new pathogen.
Yes.
They're actually not new. They're newly discovered, but they make people sick. And each time one appears, we start to pursue it.
So let's kind of then backtrack to a little sort of basic tick biology and, you know, how many kinds of ticks there are that are relevant to this conversation and so forth. They're not insects. I think people think they're insects, yeah? They're not insects.
A lot of people do think they're insects. Even people who know a lot of basic natural history know you're absolutely right. They're more closely related to mites and spiders.
Mm-hmm.
So they're not insects at all. The adult stage has 8 legs, not 6 like all insects do.
Mm-hmm.
There are dozens of species of ticks in North America and hundreds more throughout the world. Only a handful of them are really important vectors of human disease. The main one in the Northeast and upper Midwest is, and other parts of the eastern half of the U.S. is the black-legged tick, Ixodes scapularis. There's a western relative of the black-legged tick that lives in California and
I've been
elsewhere.
Reading about from work from Berkeley, from UC Berkeley, about explorations of what's going on with other animals and their relationship to that species.
That's
I
right.
think, yeah,
really
interesting.
I've been involved in some research out in California that looks at the importance of the western fence lizard. And more recent research that
birds.
Maybe what you're referring to has to do with birds.
Yeah.
So birds seem to be importing these western black-legged ticks into some urban and suburban areas in the Bay Area and elsewhere.
Yeah. So there's a lot of ticks on the planet, lots of different species, but a relatively small number are implicated in the diseases that are we believe are of concern to us. And the tick... So you talked about this a little bit because you spoke about the mouse, the white-footed mouse in particular, and other mammals. So let's talk about kind of how the diseases that we know about, how these mammals are part of the cycle of disease transmission and so forth, how it works. Because
sure.
This is the other thing I think people always talk, especially when it comes to Lyme disease, probably the most familiar disease, people always say deer tick. And that's not really the right association, is it?
No, it's actually, that is the common name that many people use, but it's actually not a correct one. And
mm-hmm.
Believe it or not, there are rules for naming species, and there kind of have to be. If there weren't rules, we wouldn't really know what we were talking about. Certainly gardeners know this very well.
Yes.
There can be a lot of confusion. So in the animal world, as well as the plant world, we have rules, and deer tick is not a correct name. It's actually the black-legged tick. But the reason it was called the deer tick is because shortly after the emergence of Lyme disease in New England in the 1970s and early 80s, scientists thought they were dealing with a newly described species of tick that had previously been unknown. And so they named it. They gave it a scientific name and the common name, the deer tick, and only about 10 years later was it realized that wasn't, in fact, a new species at all.
Oh.
It was just a northern population
of
a species that had been described 200 years ago, and that was the black-legged tick.
Oh, dear.
So there was a rule of precedence, and it's the black-legged tick.
Okay.
Interestingly, in terms of the role of animals in the life cycle and the importance of the disease agents, it turns out that these ticks, all the ticks that transmit diseases to humans, fail to transmit these pathogens from the mother to her babies. So every new generation of ticks hatches out of eggs free of infection.
Oh.
So in order to become dangerous to us, they need to acquire these pathogens somewhere.
Oh.
And the place where they get them is largely from mice and other small mammals.
So we are blaming the tick, but the tick is a messenger,
it's not the source. Well, I mean, yeah, it's a chicken and egg question in a way. The tick is the vector, so it's the creature that is transmitting it to us, and it's acquiring it from these cute little white-footed mice.
I don't think they're cute, so you don't have to be polite with me about
that.
Well,
I wonder what Pliny the Elder thought about mice. But certainly, you know, I don't know how many. I've trapped and handled tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of mice through my career. And, you know, I guess I no longer find them cute either, but a lot of people do. You know, in essence, their bodies are a filthy breeding ground for pathogens
mm-hmm.
of various kinds, and the ticks are simply, as you put it, the messenger that transmits them to us.
So a tick doesn't come into the world infected. So what happens? And it has a multi-stage life cycle. Yes.
Exactly.
So kind
yes,
of what happens?
Does.
Where does it get infected? At what phase?
So they hatch out of eggs into the larval stage.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the most tiny creatures. They're barely visible. You have no idea when they're crawling on your skin or even if they're embedded in your skin and sucking your blood. They're that small. If those larval ticks happen to bite a white-footed mouse, then they're highly likely to, first of all, survive the experience. There are other hosts that tend to kill those larval ticks by grooming. Mice are not good groomers. and those larvae feeding on mice are highly likely to acquire an infection because the mice have these pathogens floating around in their bloodstreams. So those larvae, after feeding on a mouse, or also to some extent chipmunks or even shrews, they molt the next year into the nymph stage. Mm-hmm. And that's the stage that is most dangerous to people. Those are the critters that come out in May and June, so coming right up. And if there are a lot of mice available for the larvae to be biting, then there will be a lot of infected nymphs about a year later.
Okay. So you didn't mention voles. You said chipmunks. You said white-footed mouse. You said chipmunks. You said shrews. You didn't mention voles. Is there a reason?
The reason is that voles tend not to be good, what we call reservoirs for these pathogens.
Oh, that's so interesting, because you see, in my head, I would have lumped it together, those four, you know, small mammal things together.
Yeah, so there's some degree of habitat segregation between them. You know, the voles, the most common voles are in North America are open habitat critters. They like grasslands, meadows, and old fields. And that tends not to be where the ticks are. Ticks don't like that kind of habitat.
So do they like leaf litter and so forth?
They
more?
Like leaf litter. They like an overstory of trees or
all
at least
right.
shrubs. Yeah. Oh. So there's some degree of separation.
I see. Great. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to derail you. It's just, it was curious to me. Why not the voles, too? And you mentioned predators, and did you mean predators of ticks or predators of these the mice and chipmunks and so forth? Like who help or in the equation here?
Well, both would in theory. The predators on ticks have been to be honest, predators on ticks and predators on these small mammals have both been poorly studied with respect to Lyme disease, but. What we're focusing on now are the predators on the little critters, the small mammals,
okay.
the mice and chipmunks. And there are a couple of different ways that these predators, and I'm thinking here of foxes, bobcats, raccoons, opossums, some of these are really good at reducing the abundance of the mice and chipmunks. And that does us a huge favor because we know that Lyme disease risk is related to how many mice and chipmunks there are running around in the woods. But the other thing that some of these predators can do, especially opossums and raccoons, is in addition to eating some mice, they actually attract some ticks away from mice and onto them.
Oh.
And it turns out that opossums, and we suspect also raccoons, though we haven't studied them as well, are very good at killing ticks. They groom them off, swallow them, and kill them. And any tick that survives to feed on an opossum or a raccoon has a very low probability of becoming infected. So even if they survive, they won't be dangerous to us.
I think I saw in an interview, I don't know how many years ago, or a newspaper story or something, the word hoovering up ticks, or the phrase that opossums hoover up ticks, and I loved it, I thought, because, you know, they're the most curious of creatures, so prehistoric looking.
They are.
And their habits and their, you know, fascinating animals. But the idea, I had no idea that they, in their diet, was ticks. They hoovered up ticks.
They do. So they do it in a couple of ways. You know, I think I borrowed that phrase from David Attenborough, actually. But they, you know, they move slowly and deliberately along the forest floor. And one thing folks should realize is that, you know, ticks are a sit and wait parasite. They don't move very well on their own. Especially these black-legged ticks, they are wimpy crawlers. So they pretty much just sit there, and they're waiting for something warm-blooded.
Something with a pulse, huh?
Something with a pulse. You know, feathers and fur help.
Yes,
If they come close, then the tick will climb on board.
And okay.
So opossums are, you know, this big, you know, big, slow-moving,
yes.
warmth-radiating, you know, CO2-blowing creature. And all those things are attractive to ticks. So the ticks will climb on to the opossum, if there are opossums there, first. And then each individual opossum can hoover up quite a number, you know, hundreds, even thousands of ticks, and then they'll kill the vast majority of them because they go around licking off their fur.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's curtains to those ticks, and then the ones that survive, for reasons we don't understand, they don't pick up the infection from the opossums very readily.
So in on the other end of the sort of predation equation is someone who eats the creatures that do infect the ticks, like the fox you mentioned. So a good year for fox is a little less of a good year for ticks, maybe.
That's right. And what we're looking at right now is our places where there are good, healthy fox populations, the same places where we see fewer infected ticks.
Well, and you know, of course, then one always wants to have anecdotal, and I'm not a scientist, so I always want to either anthropomorphize an animal or have anecdotal proof.
You're not alone. Yes.
I'm outside all the time, and I have been for my whole adult life, and I'm crawling around in the leaf litter and the underbrush, and I've never, thankfully, I mean, I've been bitten a couple of times. I've never been infected with a tick-borne disease, and one of my favorite things about my garden, my property, is that I normally have a fox family living in the garden. And not that that's cause and effect, and of course it's just, again, anecdotal and silly, but not scientific. But I do, you know, I loved seeing that because I think these are some of the animals that opossums, fox, people, maybe they're afraid or they're confused by them. They don't understand their place in the order of things and the role, the complex role and the contribution that they make, so...
Yeah, that's a good point. And you know, yes, it's true, your own personal experience is an anecdote, but a whole lot of anecdotes make data. And so that's what we go out and collect. If there are places like yours that have fox dens all the time,
mm-hmm.
and then there are a whole lot of other places that don't, we can compare those and actually make a strong inference using scientific
right.
methods.
Right.
One of the interesting outcomes of this is you notice that, you know, we've expanded from deer. Many people think that tick population and Lyme disease risk is closely tied to deer. We actually have not found that, to it being closely tied to mice, which it is, but there are also a number of other players involved, protective animals. And so our research has really been directed at asking what's the role of animal diversity in influencing our health, particularly when it comes to tick-borne disease. And what we find in general is that high animal diversity has a pretty strongly protective effect when it comes to tick-borne disease, not just Lyme, but babesiosis, anaplasmosis, these other tick-borne infections.
So high animal diversity is good in so many ways, and this is another example of that.
That's right. I think, you know, in many cases, many people value diversity quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
We don't want to see species disappear, much less go extinct. And in many cases, the reasons for valuing it are ethical or moral, and rarely are they actually utilitarian. You know, is there something specific that this high diversity is doing for our benefit, for our well-being? And we know that there's a lot of research going on in the ecological community asking that very question. Are there utilitarian values of biodiversity?
Mm-hmm.
And indeed, the more we look, the more we find
mm-hmm.
them.
So these are some examples.
These are some examples that are close to home because we care about our health.
So in the last, 5 minutes that we have or so, I want to just talk a little bit about a recent paper you did looking at the effect of a shifting climate or the change in when spring comes, so to speak. Should Tick Awareness Month be in April, maybe, in the Northeast instead of May? That's one thing that we haven't kind of touched on yet. Is the time that you are suiting up and going out and actively doing the research, has that shifted since the beginning of the study?
It has.
Yeah.
It has. We've been forced to go out earlier. You know, this is one of the benefits of having undertaken a very long-term project. We're, you know, well past 20 years now, and we have a weather station here at the Cary Institute, so we know from those data that our climate in this part of the world, as is true virtually everywhere, has been warming, even over the past couple of decades. It's kind of surprising how quickly things can warm up. And so we've been able to track when these ticks start to appear and when do they peak on these mice and chipmunks that we go trapping pretty much between April and November of every single year.
I see.
And we found that the ticks are coming out earlier and earlier, the warmer it is, and that that's a fairly long-term trend, and we expect that the peak will be up to 3 or 4 weeks earlier than it was just a few decades ago, in very short order. So
yeah.
We think that people need to be warned earlier now, and that May is probably too late.
So you go out collecting ticks, but everybody else wants to repel them, and so I feel compelled to ask as our final question, what's your advice to those of us not studying in the name of science, you know, who want to avoid them? I'm big on vigilance. I'm not a big user of DEET or whatever, but that's just my personal, you know, preference, and I'm into the body check thing. I don't know what you advise, because certainly you know a lot about them.
Well, the body checks do work.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I would advocate for a multifaceted approach.
Right.
There's no silver bullet. Body checks definitely work. A lot of people don't like using DEET, but it is fairly effective. It's
yes.
not perfect, but it does repel ticks. There are sprays you can put on your clothing that are
yes.
based on permethrin. Those are effective in killing ticks that get onto your clothing. Knowing what ticks look like and where they tend to crawl, which is into soft, warm, vascularized skin. So, you know, looking all over, but especially the armpits, the groin, the back of the neck. And then knowing what the early symptoms of these tick-borne diseases are like, so you can seek medical attention
mm-hmm.
at the early stage
mm-hmm.
and don't remain sick for long.
Mm-hmm. So when does the work begin again? Well, I know that you're always working, but when are you out and about again? Momentarily, yes?
We've been out since the first week of April.
Oh, okay.
So,
all right.
Yeah, I mean, it makes it difficult for us. I wish the climate weren't changing for many reasons. One of them is that we have to start earlier every year, but we've been out. I have a crew that's out essentially every day and will be until November. And I join them when I can.
Well, Dr. Richard Ostfeld of Cary Institute for Ecosystem Studies in Millbrook, New York, talking about ticks. And thank you so much. I think it's so important for people to make the bigger connection and not just point their finger at the tick, but talk about the whole cycle. So it's been great to speak to you, and I hope to speak to you again.
Thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Okay, and it's been good to speak to all the rest of you, too. Don't miss an episode. Tune in every week or get the podcast on Stitcher or iTunes. You can find me at awaytogarden.com or at facebook.com/awaytogarden.
Away to Garden with Margaret Roach is a joint production of awaytogarden.com and the smallest NPR station in the nation, Robin Hood Radio.